Government Operations and Elections Committee will come to order. We do have a quorum. I do need to make a correction to the minutes. I was actually excused at our last meeting. I was not present, so I'll make that motion. Any other changes or corrections? All those in favor of the motion or the minutes of Tuesday, May 10th, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. Minutes are approved. First on our item of business is House File 650, Representative Kiefer. Representative Kiefer, is it correct that this bill goes to rules?
Madam Chair, I'm not sure. Yes? Okay.
I will move House File 650 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Rules. Two-year bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. House File 650 is a bill that simply asks that the Minnesota Department of Transportation make sure that driver's education courses teach about the characteristics, the deadly characteristics of carbon monoxide and its potential to kill people. It works differently in cold weather, and I don't think a lot of people understand that. At this point, Madam Chair, I'd like to introduce a testifier that can kind of give the background of why this bill is being presented today and the importance of it.
Okay, please come forward. Welcome to the committee. If you could just please state your name, and I guess that's all we need for the tape today.
Okay.
Just state your name.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Kelly Lavers. I'd like to thank you for this opportunity to discuss with you House File 650 for Tyler's Law. And please excuse me if I read this, my testimony.
That would be fine.
I'm really nervous.
No, don't be nervous.
Okay. This bill requests that there be a simple modification to the Minnesota Driver's Manual and that a question about the dangers of carbon monoxide poisoning be included on each permit test. The driver's education teachers are asked to review the risks and the potential speed of death from carbon monoxide poisoning. As well, they are asked to discuss safe idling practices. My son Tyler, 19 years young, died this past December as the result of accidental carbon monoxide poisoning while working on his car. The combination of cold air, the cold start of his engine, the absence of abundant airflow in the garage, and the lack of understanding of how this silent, odorless, colorless, tasteless, deadly gas operates, it ultimately cost him his life. The medical examiner estimated that Tyler was unconscious within a few minutes. Carbon monoxide can impair your ability to save yourself and take you down before you know what hits you. Since this tragic date, we have learned of unfortunate Minnesotans who've died needlessly from accidental carbon monoxide poisoning while working on a vehicle, as well, in their open garage. We know that our son's death, as well as other tragic deaths, could have been avoided had there been better understanding of carbon monoxide. Very soon after Tyler's death, we quickly became aware of some of the less known dangers of this deadly, yet 100% preventable poisoning. Organizations such as the Environmental Protection Agency, the Center for Disease Control, Customer Product Safety Commission, just to name a few, even the indoor carbon monoxide detector guides and some garage door companies have published material that states specifically it is never safe to idle a vehicle in a garage, even with the door open. First responders, police, fire, paramedics, and medical examiners are all too aware of this danger as well, and have written letters to us, some of which you may have copies of, and have published information on the acute risk of carbon monoxide poisoning. From these resources, we have learned that our cold winter temperatures pose a greater risk to our populace. These professionals are telling us that opening the garage door does not keep us safe when idling a vehicle in a garage, and at no time should you believe otherwise. Due to the cold temperatures, the carbon monoxide is not going to escape the garage. It will likely separate from the exhaust that you see and that you smell. It will congregate in the warmer parts of the garage and ultimately find its way into an attached structure. And while carbon monoxide can poison or kill a person in the garage, also it can penetrate into the attached home, seeping into the rooms above or adjacent to the garage, and sometimes silently killing those who live there. I cannot tell you the number of people whom have shared with us, and that includes legislators, that they too didn't know some of these carbon monoxide dangers, that they will now pull their cars out of the garage when they warm them up in the wintertime. Our son Tyler paid the ultimate price, working in a condition that he believed to be safe, but actually was not. We're certain that had he possessed the knowledge that we feel should be included in the Minnesota Driver's Education Program, and had he been tested on these important facts regarding the dangers of carbon monoxide, that he would be alive today. Tyler believed in the concept of empowerment. He believed in being informed and making an informed decision. He believed it so much so that he wore a bracelet that was engraved with the word empowered. And for Tyler's funeral, his friends printed these green and white wristbands that hold not only his name, but the word, the meaningful, powerful word, empowered. With education comes empowerment. I strongly urge you and thank you for supporting House File 650 as it educates and it empowers. When I ask you to support this, I ask you to do it not only as a mother who suffered an unspeakable loss, I ask you as a mother who does not want another family to have to suffer a needless and preventable tragedy. I ask you as a citizen of the state, and I ask you as an informed person who knows that the action from this bill will save lives. So, on behalf of my family and friends, we're really grateful for your time today. Thank you so much.
Thank you, and thanks for coming forward. I know it had to be very difficult to come here and testify in front of a committee and on this, so, and we're so sorry to hear of your tragedy. Representative Scalzi.
Thank you, Ms. Chair, and thank you so much for coming in to bring this in front of us, because I, like your state representative, didn't realize. I always thought that if you left the garage door open, you were fine. And so could you just maybe explain what happens to the gas? Does it just ball up when it reaches cold temperatures?
Ms. Lavers?
Thank you, Madam Chair. What happens is, yeah, it doesn't want to escape into the colder temperatures, and so it's funny how it kind of separates from the other exhaust that's coming out of a vehicle, and it pools into the warmer areas. It almost like seeks warmth, if that makes sense, yeah. And because in the summertime it doesn't matter, because a lot of times it's just as warm outside as it is inside the garage. But the wintertime is the tricky time. And when your engine is cold, the catalytic converter produces more carbon monoxide when the catalytic converter is cold than when it's not. And so in the summertime, your catalytic converter in the vehicle is not as cold either.
Did anybody else have any questions or comments? Representative Beard.
Madam Chair and members, we heard this in Transportation Committee as well, where we also heard testimony as the effect of carbon monoxide in a warm environment when there's a garage door open, and it doesn't act the way you thought it would. It kind of surprises you. But the bill is in front of this committee today after it went through Ways and Means, because we instruct the commissioner to adopt rules for driver ed programs that do the classroom portion of the teaching today. And I think that public safety may have a few brief comments, but the way we put it together in Transportation, it appeared that most of the instructions can be absorbed, the cost of the instructions and the rulemaking can be absorbed by the department. And since they're not printing driver's education manuals at the moment, everything is online, so the cost of distributing this information widely should be a minimal cost to the department. But if anyone has particular questions of the department because of the rulemaking portion that falls under the purview of this committee, perhaps we could ask them to come down and testify if you wish.
Is there anyone else? Mr. Jordahl, if you'd like to come forward.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Jared Jordahl with the Department of Public Safety. We have no problem whatsoever with this bill. It is true that we have some rulemaking to do with respect to instituting this as part of the curriculum and changing the driver's tests, but other than that, I think it's a good bill and we'll stand for any questions.
Thank you. Does anybody have any questions for Mr. Jordahl?
Madam Chair,
Representative Beard.
Just so the committee is clear, too, there is some exemptions to certain processes in Chapter 14, but I think in this case it certainly doesn't rise to the matter of prohibiting a chemical application or requiring another expensive action by a private individual or company. It pretty much is instructional to the client driver ed schools, and so I don't think the exemptions that are provided in on page 2, lines 2.4 and so on, would provide any particular heartburn to the committee or anything like that. So,
okay. Right, Representative Hancock.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just a question on the testing material. I'm assuming the August 1st, 2011 deadline would be like the next printing of the test, so that that could be incorporated in. Or I guess what I'm really asking is there an additional expense based upon the inclusion in the driver's test, is all.
Mr. Jordahl?
Madam Chair, Representative, the effective date does constitute, we do have exempt rulemaking, and it is just the time frame that we would need to get the curriculum up to speed, and we do the test itself online, and so there's a programming component to change the actual test to reflect that we would be asking questions about carbon monoxide poisoning, and we translate the test into some different languages, and that is also the need for the effective date. I apologize if that didn't directly answer your question. I think that is what you were asking, sir.
Representative Hancock.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think that basically answers it. I just the inclusion into the test, I thought might incur some additional expense if it were not included in its normal, but it sounds to me like it's going to be included in the normal functions of revamping and revising and updating the test on a continual basis, basically. And it takes some time to integrate that into the system. So yes, my questions are answered.
Thank you. All right, any other questions or folks wanting to testify? Representative Kiefer?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I would just ask for your support on this House File 650 and that it be referred to rules.
Okay, I will renew the motion then that House File 650 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to rules. Questions or comments on that? All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed, nay. Motion does prevail. Thank you very much. Next on the agenda is House File 1474. This is an informational only hearing. We will allow approximately 45 minutes or so for the proponents, and then we'll allow a time for the opponents as well if they would like to speak. So we will not be moving on this action today. Well, Representative Nelson did give a couple of hours to the other side of the issue the other day.
Talk longer on the environment.
Representative Anderson, if you'd like to start presenting your bill, and then we can take your witnesses as they come.
Thank you, Madam Chairman and committee members, and thank you for giving us this opportunity to explain our bill to you today. It's House File 1473, and I'm going to just kind of walk through the bill just a little bit, and then the testifiers will get into more details in the bill.
1474?
Oh, did I say the wrong name? 1474. Sorry, Madam Chair. And so if you go to page 2 of the bill, basically the first section of the bill, section 1, is about judicial elections. And if you go to item B is where the change is. So except in the judicial districts of the 2nd and the 4th judicial districts, the new procedure would be that voters residing in the county in which the judge is chambered will be voting for the judges. And then, and when you go further down, in the second and fourth judicial districts, the judges would be elected in the judicial election precinct. Then, if you continue on to section 3 of the bill, it's about judicial filing of the commitment and that they're going to run for office. So on line 3.19, a judge needs to file a commitment in writing to the Secretary of State by May 1 of the year of the expiration of the term of office of such judge. And then on line 3.26 is where we're talking about judges retiring. And when a judge reaches the age of 70, then the office of the judge shall be placed on the ballot in the general election in the year of the judge's mandatory retirement date. So instead of retiring right on their birthday, that would be a change. And then section 4, we have some definitions there for you. And then on subdivision 2, filing a judicial vacancy. And I think I'm going to have other people go into that later on, but we're going to be making a few changes for filing a judicial vacancy. And then on subdivision 21D on page 5, line 5.1, mandatory retirement date is now going to be December 31st of the year of a general election after a judge has attained 70 years of age. And then we have a early reduced the retirement date. Okay, so I went over that. So then the last part is we're changing the pensions a little bit. So in section 10, there's a little bit change if you retire early, and I'll have some other people explain that as well. So those are the basic elements and changes in this bill. And then so I'd like to have Tim Kinley just kind of give you an overview.
Welcome to the committee, and if you could just identify yourself for the tape.
Sure. Thank you, Chair, Representatives. My name is Tim Kinley. I'm me. I'm involved in a lot of groups dealing with judicial reform, but I'm here speaking on my own behalf. And these are my comments, but my purpose today is to give an overview, kind of get us caught up with the discussion that took place Tuesday on the judicial retention elections and judicial appointments, and also then lead us into the discussion, the issues on this bill. But I think it's first important to notice, and you got this handout last Tuesday, and I don't know if you have separate packages for separate bills or whatever, so we might just want to pass this out again. There's no separations of powers problems with the bill that we're presenting today, but I just want you to know that it's clear that we do have checks and balances built into our Constitution. And in this handout, I went through the Constitution and listed out all the areas where the legislature has authority over the judiciary, and there's some 24 to 26 of them. And election of the judiciary and disciplining of the judiciary are two of those areas that the legislature has jurisdiction over. And regarding impeachment, the legislature has sole authority over, or the House of Representatives has sole authority over. And when I started being involved in judicial reform 6 years ago, I would ask representatives, you know, you have this power, and unfortunately a majority said they don't. And so I think a lot of part of what this bill is starting to do is to increase and strengthen judicial accountability, because whether we go to an appointment system or retention election or keep our elections, we still have elections this coming up this next time, and we still have the problem of judicial accountability that needs to be addressed. And personally, I will never, ever give up my right to vote, and neither should you, and especially for judges. And when you lose the right to vote, it's very, very difficult to get that back, and it usually there's a high price to pay in order to get that back. Now, taking away a person's right to vote is an extremely serious proposition that needs to be avoided at all possible costs. We usually take the right to vote away from felons and not citizens, although I hear that for some reasons felons are still able to vote. Now, I'm a little bit offended that some of the elites think that they have special revelation and think they should pick for me through their political processes unaccountable judges. Because in my experience with the system, our judges are fairly unaccountable. And the accountability we do have with the Board on Judicial Standards is very weak. All the complaints run through one person. One person screens all the complaints. And so that the other 10 members on that board may not know and may not get complaints. And they're screened. And there's some, as the board has said before, there's a lot of complaints that come in, and they look about 120 of them when there's some, over a couple thousand involved in the process. And the other, I want you to understand this. You just can't take politics out of selecting judges. All that happens is, in our Constitution or in our laws, we're saying who gets to have the politics. And I think when you limit the choices and limit the people making the decision on who's going to be a judge, you increase the amount of politics involved. And also you make it easier for somebody to be bought off or paid off or having to take certain positions on certain things. And that when you tighten that circle, you have less blue sky and you have less accountability. So having elections and keeping it open, keeping it to the people, increasing the education of the citizenry about the judiciary, I think that's an important role. Because my personal opinion, the election, the process of dumbing down the electorate has taken place, and that the judiciary really doesn't want the electorate to know what they're doing in their offices. Okay. One issue here now, just kind of bring it. So we're focused on the election process that we still have and may have for a long time. And so one of the issues that is not in this bill but is planning on being in the bill is about removing the word incumbent from the ballot. That's a hindrance to letting people know and having other individuals run against the judiciary. And attorneys, they don't have the privilege of saying what happens in the courts a lot, because one of the rules is you can't disparage the courts, okay? And those that do, they get disciplined and they get come after and they get fined. But falsified transcripts is routine in our judiciary. Not every judge does it, but there's enough that do. Removal of evidence from case files, denial of transcripts, where you have to go to federal court to get copies of your own transcripts. I mean, that's a problem. And so, and you have judges writing orders on post-it notes saying denied. No evidentiary hearings, no findings of fact, no conclusions of law, just a post-it note saying denied. There's problems in our judiciary. They need to be exposed. The election system keeps that open and keeps that available. At least it's the final form of accountability that's available. And really, unfortunately, it's the only meaningful form of accountability we have today. But that in itself is very, very weak. So the whole goal here is to increase citizen participation and to have judicial accountability instead of minimizing it. And judges are to be dependent. They're not to be independent. They're dependent on the Constitution and the laws. And they need to be held accountable for that. And there needs to be a system that opens up that accountability so it's more blue sky. So somebody files a complaint to the Board of Judicial Standards, nobody knows about it. It's secret. And I think that should be opened up. So here in this bill on elections, this starts that process. At least the citizens have some effort of knowing what's going on in the judiciary and who's running for office.
Thank you very much.
Madam Chair, we have Bond Clayton.
Okay. Welcome to the committee, and if you could please state your name for the record.
Bond Clayton, Madam Chair, members, I just wanted to summarize 1474, and hopefully you'll be impressed and you can all sign on to it. That's our major goal. First, 1474 calls for election of judges by the county that they serve, or in some counties, in some areas it might be a few multiple counties, and there's a system for establishing that. The second provision is to, consistent with the wording of the state constitution, to require the governor, when he's making the appointment, to appoint interim judges, placeholders, who would serve until December of the even year, triggering an election. So we want to emphasize that we are trying to get back to what seems to be the original intent of the constitution writers, to have elections for judges in Minnesota. And the third thing is to change the retirement date, the forced retirement date, which is only in statute, which is currently the end of the month after the 70th birthday, to be the end of December after the 70th, of the even year after the 70th birthday. Some people, including retired Judge Jack Nordby, who couldn't be here today, would like it to be the end of the term. He thinks that it should be based because the Constitution says that you can fulfill your term. He thinks it should be the end of the term. The main thing, though, is to trigger an election. Now, there are several other people that are testifying here today that will go into some of these details, and I'd like to call on them. I think the first one would be Chris. Oh, Dale. Go ahead.
Thank you. And again, if you could just state your name into the microphone for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Dale Nathan. I am a member of some organizations that are seeking to make our election system consistent with our Constitution. Minnesota's Constitution states that judges shall be elected by the people from the district the judge will serve. But we all know that is not what is happening. Over 90% of all the individuals who become judges are appointed by the governor. And those appointed individuals serve for up to 2 years and then typically run as the incumbent with no opponent. So the people today really are not involved in the selection of judges or in their retention. This bill is a major, major change, and I think it is for the better. What this bill focuses on is the current statute that requires a judge to retire the last day of the month that the judge reaches the age of 70. Let's assume for a moment that the judge is going to reach the age of 70 this month, May of 2011. What that means is that on May 31st of this month, the judge must retire. What is the effect of that? It is that the governor appoints the replacement, not the people. And it's not an election, it's an appointment by the governor. And the appointed person then serves for up to 2 years under our present law, and then typically runs as the incumbent with no opponent. And you can see that this is not a system of the election of judges by the people. What this bill focuses on is changing the mandatory retirement date from the last day of the month that the judge reaches 70 to the year of a general election after the judge reaches the age of 70. So one consequence of this change would be that judges would serve up to 2 years longer as a judge. In other words, it's not automatic that the judge retires when the judge is 70. He could be 70, let's say, in January of a particular year. And this bill says, well, your mandatory retirement date now is going to be December 31st of the next election year. So you can see that a judge potentially could serve a little bit longer. But here's the other consequence, and that is if the judge's term expires on the last day of the next general election, that means that the replacement, the new judge, will be elected by the people. And that means that many voters will now be a part of the judge selection process. You may have an opinion as to whether or not it is better to have the people elect our judges or to let a select group of people appoint our judges. My personal opinion is that we should, as our Constitution says, maximize the election of judges by the people. There is a book, and I highly recommend that you become aware of this book, and if you can, read it as part of your consideration of this important bill. The book is entitled In Defense of Judicial Elections. It was written by two professors at the University of Michigan, and what this book does is very methodically evaluate the whether or not it is better to elect judges or have judges appointed. The book is 120 pages long. It comes to the conclusion that judges are far, far better if they are elected than if they are appointed. Therefore, Representative Anderson's bill, according to this book and according to many other people, would greatly improve the quality of Minnesota's judges. It would have the people involved in assessing judges. Judges would run in competitive elections. They would present themselves to the people. They would allow the people to judge the candidates and select the candidate they think is the best. We have long had some competitive elections in Minnesota, and they have proven what this book says. The people typically elect very, very good judges after they get a chance to see the judge in campaigns and to learn something about that judge. The bill goes a little bit further in trying to assure that judges are elected by the people. The bill provides that judges must commit, that the candidates, I should say, for judge, must commit at the time that they run for office that they are going to complete the term of office. The present term for a judge is 6 years. And when a person runs for a judge, that person has to certify prior to the election that if elected, the person is going to serve the full term. And I submit that's what most elected officials do. When you run for the office of representative, you should be expecting to complete at least the 2-year term for which you are running. and that's what we're asking of our judges. But the bill also provides that you can retire before the term of your office if you have a disability that makes it impossible for you to complete your term. Otherwise, if you run for a six-year term as judge, according to the bill, and you elect to retire earlier, then there is indeed a consequence, and the consequence is spelled out in the pension section, and that is a graduated reduction in some of your pension benefits if you elect to retire prior to the end of your term. Another feature of this bill is the attempt to narrow down the electorate that considers judges. Currently, if you are a resident of Hennepin County and it comes time to elect judges, if you look at your ballot, you would see something like 60 candidates for judge. And that's because Hennepin County has that many judgeships within its jurisdiction. Can you imagine how difficult it is to try to evaluate 60 candidates for judge? And in Ramsey County, similarly, there is a large number of judges. I see it's 26. So now, if you look at your ballot, you have to decide on 26 candidates for judge. Under this bill, in Hennepin and Ramsey counties, judges are assigned to particular blocks of precincts. So if you are in a block of precincts, you would have only one judgeship to consider. And that's a whole lot easier than having to consider 26. So that's the basic thrust of this bill, and I will end my testimony at that point. But of course, Madam Chair, I'll be happy to take any questions.
Thank you very much. Who do you have next, Representative Anderson?
We have one last testifier, Chris.
Okay. Welcome to the committee, and if you could just identify yourself for the tape.
My name is Chris Penwell. I was here on Tuesday. I'm testifying today both as a trial attorney for the past 26 years and as one who was a candidate in the last judicial election. I was one of the 24 candidates on the ballot in the 10th Judicial District. Obviously, there's a significant contrast between Tuesday's bill, HF 1666, and today's bill. Tuesday's bill was about codifying the system that is currently in place. What it would do is simply eliminate the 7% or so of contested elections that occur each election cycle, and then would add an evaluation process that is not currently in place. The justifications for that bill are, first of all, a fear that partisan, expensive elections are coming to Minnesota. It's not happened so far, but there's a fear that that is coming. And secondly, that the voters don't have enough information to make an informed decision about judicial candidates. Today's bill is about getting back to what the framers of the Constitution intended, which was that judges would be elected in contested elections, and it's simply designed to provide a financial disincentive for judges to retire before the end of their term, and when they do so, of course, the judge appoints their successor. So it really, the legislature at some point is going to have to decide whether the appointment of a judge by the governor is less political and less partisan than a contested election. And the people that are speaking on behalf of this bill believe that in fact a contested election will ultimately be less political and less partisan than an appointment by the government under the current system. I do want to say a couple of things, first of all, about the portion of the bill that would require only the county in which the judge is chambered to vote. I can speak from personal experience on that. The election that I was in, the judge that prevailed in that election is chambered in Washington County. The 10th Judicial District covers 8 counties. It's an enormous geographic area. I literally put at least 200 miles a day on my car over the course of 2-plus months in crisscrossing those eight counties, trying to talk to the voters there. It's a little bit of a perverse outcome that the person that carried Washington County, that happened to be me, but that's beside the point, didn't win the election, that somebody that lives outside of Washington County actually won that election. So the people that were most affected, that is Washington County, their choice was not the person that was elected. As I say, that seems to be a bit of a perverse outcome. As I crisscrossed the 8 counties, people said to me again and again, you know, when I was in Anoka or Sherburne or wherever, you know, why are you here? If the seat is in Washington County, why am I voting on your in your election? And everybody was very passionate about wanting to vote for a judge, but just confused about why they were voting for a judge in Washington County. So this particular part of the bill seems to be simple common sense, and hopefully not controversial. As I said, the remainder of the bill, just to summarize it, is really to provide a financial disincentive for judges to retire early, so that we can have contested elections in every circumstance, unless there is a reason that a judge is retiring that has to do with something that is other than simply a desire to have the governor appoint the replacement. So, as I said, the legislature is going to have to make a kind of a threshold call on this as to whether it's better to have the people vote or to have the governor make an appointment. And I know there's going to be a lot more discussion on that subject, but that's really the nub of the debate here. And hopefully, in the end, you will determine that it's better to have contested elections and let the people vote, but simply get them better information about judicial candidates. And just one last point is that if in my case the election had been just in Washington County alone, I would have been able to spend all my time, as would have the other candidates, in Washington County informing the electorate in Washington County about my qualifications and the other candidates as well. So if we didn't have to cover 8 counties, we can concentrate on that county and get people a lot more information, which both sides of this debate say is a major frustration of people, that they just don't know enough about judicial candidates. So restrict the area that we have to campaign, and we're going to be able to get more and better information into the hands of voters. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Representative Anderson.
Is that all of your witnesses?
That's all my testifiers. Did you have any questions at all about any parts of the bill? If anybody had questions about some parts of the bill, it would be good to have them ask them to the people that I have here today.
Okay, I think perhaps I'll take some questions now. I know there are a few people that would like to testify in opposition to the bill too, so we'll take a few questions and then maybe we can get the other folks up. And I know they've been waiting, and I apologize. It's been a much longer session, so I know if there are people that were here waiting, I apologize for that. But does anybody have any questions now? Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We've heard some statements this afternoon about how the practice of judges retiring before their term ends and their subsequent their vacancies being appointed by the governor as being contrary to the Constitution. And so I pulled out the state constitution to take a look, and it does say Section 7 of Article 6 says that judges will be elected by the voters from the area in which they served as provided by law. Where there's a vacancy in the office of judge, the governor shall appoint. It provides that they can be a mandatory retirement age. It says that judicial districts can be defined by law. I didn't see anything in the bill that corrects any current practice that is in any way contrary to the Constitution, and I wonder if you could clarify that.
Mr. Benwell?
Certainly. I think you were focused on Section 6. Is that right?
Representative Winkler.
I'm sorry, Section 7 says...
Mr. Benwell.
I'm sorry.
Please proceed.
Oh, Madam Chair, I apologize. Section 7 says that judges shall be elected by the voters from the area which they are to serve in the manner provided by law. Then Section 8 covers vacancies. Whenever there is a vacancy in the office of judge, the governor shall appoint, in the manner provided by law, a qualified person to fill the vacancy until a successor is elected and qualified. So in both Section 7 and Section 8, it's in my view, it is clearly contemplated. First of all, it says they shall be elected, and then the governor appoints until a successor is elected. So the clear contemplation of the framers is that judges would be elected, and that a vacancy or the appointment by the governor would be in the rare circumstance in which the judge's seat is vacated prior to the end of the term. And what has happened is, I got chided by Representative Simon, so I want to be careful about the way I say it. But there's clearly a choice on the part of judges to retire early for the purpose of allowing the governor to appoint their successor. And given the clear language of the Constitution about electing judges, I simply believe that that's not the intent of the Constitution. I hope that answers the question.
Representative Winkler. Well,
Madam Chair, Mr. Penwell, or anybody else, what I don't understand is how the current practice in any way violates the Constitution. I understand that for all intents and purposes, many judges retire, possibly because of the 70 retirement age requirement, possibly because they want to have their successor appointed, but there's nothing in there that's contrary to the Constitution, as far as I can tell. They can retire when they want, their replacement can be appointed, and then they're subject to election like everybody else. So how is that contrary to the constitutional requirements?
Mr. Nathan, did you want to answer that one?
Madam Chair, yes, thank you. The Representative Winkler, the problem is compounded by the statutory definition of the mandatory retirement date. In other words, we create vacancies by requiring judges to retire on the last day of the month that they attain the age of 70. So by changing the definition of the mandatory retirement date, so that it's December 31st of the next election year, we are eliminating the creation of vacancies merely because the judge reaches the retirement age of 70 in a given month. So the changes we are making are completely consistent with the constitutional provisions we've referred to here, one being the constitutional mandate that judges will be elected by the people from the district they are serving, and the second one being that when a vacancy occurs, what we hope would become rare instance, that the successor would be appointed by the governor. Under the scheme proposed in this bill, what happens is that almost every judge would retire on December 31st of an election year, which automatically means that the successor to that retiring judge would be elected in the November elections just before the last day of that judge. That's the way I'm looking at it, and I hope that is a satisfactory answer for you.
Representative Winkler.
Okay. Madam Chair, Mr. Nathan, I don't know. I don't have a reason to think that what you're proposing here is unconstitutional. Although I think, tying somebody's pension to a retirement date and only allowing them to retire if they have some physical impairment, might be questionable. But I'm not saying that your proposal is unconstitutional. What I want to do is dispel any kind of misinformation that the current practice for appointing and electing judges is in any way unconstitutional or contrary to the Constitution. Everything that we do is specifically called out. So I just want to make sure that there isn't misinformation here, that somehow the current practice for filling vacancies and running for re-election after appointment, et cetera, is in any way unconstitutional. And I haven't heard any reason for that so far. but I want the record to be clear, and I want all my colleagues to understand that what we do now is consistent with the constitutional language.
Mr. Clayton.
Madam Chair, Representative Winkler, yes, it is consistent, although there are words in Article 6, Section 7 and 8, I believe, that say, as provided by law. And we want to use those words to provide some statutes which get back to what seems to be the original intent of the drawers of the Constitution, which was in the context of the Dred Scott decision, which came down in February of 1857. It was mentioned on Tuesday in brief, but that was probably the most unpopular of all judicial activist decisions, whichever definition you use of judicial activism. Because not only did it send Dred Scott back to his slave owner, but it made unconstitutional the Missouri Compromise, which some people think was the major cause of the Civil War. So as a consequence, whether or not you interpret it that way, the judicial activism caused by Judge Taney resulted in 39 states establishing judicial elections. Now, that's a significant milieu in which to consider the intention of our Constitution writers. And we are trying to get back to an emphasis on judicial elections because of that.
Representative Winkler.
Madam Chair, I'm sure the opponents will testify. I understand that your intention is to make more prevalent the practice of electing people in the first instance to the bench rather than having them be appointed and then having an incumbency designation on the ballot. Mm-hmm. I understand that's your intention. I don't agree with it, but I think that's a legitimate point to make. I just want to make sure that there isn't any confusion around the fact that what we do now is fully consistent with the text of the state constitution. That's my only point.
Mr. Penwell?
Madam Chair, 30 seconds. Representative Winkler, in fairness, I agree with you. I think it is technical compliance with the Constitution. I don't think it is in compliance with the original intent of the framers. I believe the words "shall be elected" evinces an intent that the vast majority of judges would be elected through contested elections, and that it would be a rare exception that there would be a vacancy where that would be filled by an appointment from the governor. And I think that the wording of that supports that that interpretation of the intent. And so if that is the intent, then I think it's fair to say that we're trying to get back to the original intent of the framers and get away from what is now, I think you'd have to admit, a systematic choice by judges to retire early in 90%+ of the cases, so that there are virtually no or very few contested elections in this state currently.
Representative Anderson?
I guess we do have one more of our testifiers did arrive, so if they're depending on if you want to take her or any more questions.
Okay, we'll have, there's another member that has a question, then we'll take that witness, and then we'll move on. Representative Quam?
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, not being a member of the bar and being a humble farm boy, I was trying to remember and recall from previous testimony and the number 90% or thereabouts. Does anyone in the staff, can they let me know approximately how many judges, presently sitting judges, were initially appointed versus being elected, or if you've got something over a decade, but just the ballpark so we understand the quantity of appointment versus elected for origination of a judgeship.
Mr. Clayton?
Madam Chair, I understand that it's 94. Representative Beard in his testimony on Tuesday said it was 93, so we're pretty close to agreement on that.
Representative Palm.
Madam Chair, thank you, Bond. Then I guess I understand why there is a concern. You know, I would say if there was, you know, 20% or a small portion that were appointed, it wouldn't show an indication of an intent to not allow open judgeships. to appear on the ballot. But when greater than 90% are from appointments, and I would hazard to say that almost all of the remaining 6% or 7% were from successful challenges, but that does indicate that we really are not at the original intent. Hearing this testimony and the previous testimony, I'm wondering if there's a blend between their proposal and that if no one was contested, it'd be a retention election or, you know, a compromise between the two plans. Has there ever been any discussion from the people at the testimonies table on a compromise, a meeting in between, keeping some of the good points that they're proposing of better information, sort of a ranking from an impartial committee to give some background and information, websites, and et cetera?
Mr. Clayton?
Madam Chair, Representative Quam, yes, you mentioned this to me about a month ago, and our committee has discussed it a couple of times. One idea is that under the current system, even with some changes we're currently talking about, if a judge, any judge running for re-election or election, does not get 51%, then he would not be elected. I mean, I'm not sure that that would please people, but at least it's an idea of a compromise. It's a retention with our current system.
And Madam Chairman?
Representative Anderson.
As the chief author of this bill, too, and having an informational hearing, we do want to hear from you and the members of your committee, how you feel about the bill, issues that you have with the bill, and if there's different things in the bill you don't like, of ways that we need to modify the bill. So.
Thank you. Well,
we'd like to work with your committee on the different issues.
Okay, we'll keep that in mind. I think we'll go to the last witness then for the proponents. If you could just please identify yourself for the tape, and if you could maybe get a little closer to the microphone there.
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Jill Clark, and I'm a licensed attorney, practice in Minnesota, and have been practicing over 20 years. And just as a point of information, my assistant and I, within the last year, did look at 327 trial judges, and our statistics are that between 96 and 97% were selected by appointment. And for Court of Appeals judges, it is, of course, 100% selected by appointment. And as many people probably know, for the Supreme Court, only one justice was selected by election, and that, of course, is Alan Page. The bill is interesting to me because the problem of requiring judges to retire at 70, I think, has two main prongs. First of all, there are some very talented, skilled, experienced, wise trial judges that must leave the bench on that date. And I think that's something that bears speaking to. The law is something that I think we get better at over time. And I have, and I won't name names, but I certainly have been quite distressed as an attorney to see some of our finest, most experienced trial judges be forced to leave the bench on this arbitrary date. As you probably know, it is not that way in the federal system, and there are many judges over the age of 70 in the federal system who do fine, fine work. But the second prong is that it really takes elections from the people. And with due respect, my position is that, no, the First Amendment of the United States Constitution is being regularly violated in Minnesota by taking elections away from members of the public, and that, in fact, there are sections of the Minnesota Constitution, as interpreted by our esteemed Supreme Court, that violate the First Amendment of the United States Constitution. So when you look at the vehicles with which we remove elections from the public, an important one is this retirement at 70. It forces judges to retire midterm. I mean, the chances that your birthday will fall on the end of your term are statistically improbable, such that almost every seat comes up midterm, and the result has been a gubernatorial appointment. There's an oath that judges take to serve 6 years. If you look at the Constitution, it says 6-year term. And when judges stand up and say to the people that they've run in a campaign to seek their trust, I will serve for 6 years, that's my oath, and then they retire midterm, There's a trust issue, but they're also removing that election from the public. This is just one vehicle. Obviously, there are early resignations, which is another problem that it certainly appears this bill is seeking to address. So I speak in favor of the bill. I wanted to make that kind of focused point about it, but I would certainly answer any questions if anyone has them.
Any questions? I think at this time, then, I think I will turn it over and have the folks who have come to speak against the bill come forward. I think we'll have start with Judge Meslow. Welcome back to the legislature, Judge Meslow, Your Honor.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It does bring back memories.
I hope
some of them good. But as I watched the session go on today, past expectations, it brought back other memories. I can remember those times that I would call my wife and say, well, we're just about done. I think 10 minutes from now, this floor session is going to wrap up. It sounds like it's winding down. And I'd call an hour later and say, I have no idea when this is going to end. Those aren't my favorites of those memories. But Madam Chair, members of the committee, it is a pleasure to be back here. I appreciate the opportunity to speak on House File 1474. That bill reflects a philosophy that new judges are better chosen by general election than they are by a merit selection process. I respectfully disagree with that philosophy. And for those of you who don't know me, let me tell you a little bit about my background. I stood for two elections to serve here in the House of Representatives under party designation. I also stood for two elections for the White Bear Lake Area School Board that was a nonpartisan election, very contested elections. General election process was absolutely the right process to follow for each of those positions, and it's because of the way that works, and you know it well. Candidates are able to campaign. Candidates are able to raise money. Candidates are able to state their positions on the issues. What that means is the voters know what they're voting for. They know who they're voting for. They know who they're voting against. And they have that clear information. All that's really valuable. Judicial elections, by law and by rule, don't provide those opportunities. Candidates running for judge can't solicit or accept contributions themselves. They can have a committee that does that, but they can't even know who gave to their campaign and who didn't. Candidates for judicial positions can't discuss any existing cases, so they can't say, well, here's what I'm doing with this case, here's how I'm handling that, or this is how I think this judge should be handling this case differently. They can't take positions on cases or issues that may come before them. And so to take a controversial issue that may come to the courts and say, well, this is how I would decide this issue if it came before me, candidates can't say that. They're not allowed to do that. Here's what it means. In a contested election, it's a question of who's got the most lawn signs. It's a question of who's got the most name recognition. That may turn out to provide the person who's better qualified to be a judge, but there's no correlation between those two things. You may or may not get the better qualified judge if all you're relying on is number of lawn signs, amount of name recognition. I know that this committee on Tuesday heard the testimony of Judge Thompson where he talked about the merit selection process and how all that works. I'm not going to recover that ground for you. I'd be happy to answer any questions about that if you like, but I know that's something you always heard about. I'll just say that the merit selection process is an opportunity to screen the candidates for their qualifications and, frankly, for their disqualifications. Is it a perfect system? It's not. But I'm convinced that it's better calculated to find qualified judges who are going to decide civil and criminal cases that the people bring before them. And that's what's so important, is to make sure that we've got qualified judges who are ready and prepared to do that. House File 1474 is, as Mr. Nathan said, a major step in a different direction. I would respectfully disagree with him in that I would say it's a step in the wrong direction and would be a mistake for this committee to move forward. Having talked about that in broad terms, I want to just identify a couple of the specifics within the bill that raise concerns for me. First, there's the provision that talks about electing judges only in counties where they're chambered or even in Hennepin and Ramsey counties, breaking that down into precincts. Let's start by talking about that in Hennepin and Ramsey County. First, to correct something that Mr. Nathan said, you don't see 60 judges in Hennepin County on the ballot all at the same time. It's still a big number, but what happens is there are six-year terms, a third are up each time. And so in Hennepin County, what you'd see is 20 judges that would be on the ballot at the same time. That's a big number, I agree, but it's not 60. In Ramsey County, what you're going to see is out of the 26 judges, you'll see 8 or 9 on the ballot at the same time. But there has never been an election where 60 judges were on the ballot at the same time in the 4th Judicial District. If you then look at that in the 4th District, which is the same as Hennepin County, the 2nd District, which is the same as Ramsey County, to artificially create judicial precincts simply doesn't reflect reality. Judges don't hear cases within that county based upon sections of the county. They hear them based upon the types of cases that they are. Judges may be hearing family cases. They may be hearing misdemeanor cases or felonies or civil cases, but there's nothing that breaks it down into some kind of judicial precinct. And so creating judicial precincts within those counties, within those districts, is a purely artificial process. As you then take the greater Minnesota situation, it is very common that judges will divide their weeks among multiple counties and divide their years that way so that they may be in 2 counties, 3 counties, even 4 counties for roughly approximate periods of time. It doesn't reflect that reality. Even in the suburban counties, and I serve in Anoka County primarily, that's where I'm seated, there is some sharing that goes on. And the reason for that is Anoka County is within the 10th Judicial District. That covers 10 counties, all the way from Washington County up north to Kanabic County and out west to Sherburne County. Within each of those counties, there are different needs, different percentages and needs. And so right now we've got 17 judges in Anoka County. Because there are fewer in some of the other counties and because based upon the number of cases they're hearing, that makes them short, we're sharing and we're going to the other counties. I was in Washington County this morning hearing cases. Another of the Anoka County judges was in Sherburne County yesterday. Another Anoka County judge was in Kanabic County on Monday. And so we don't just sit in one county, even as suburban judges. We move around where the need arises. And that's what the judicial districts are designed to recognize, is that the needs are being met and judges have jurisdiction throughout those entire judicial districts. So the concept of narrowing down the election district is simply not a reflection of the reality of what happens within the court system. The other thing that I want to highlight is to talk about this concept of a placeholder who would sit as a judge for a period of months. I guess the longest conceivable period of time would be just under 2 years, but many of those would be a period of months. I'll just tell you frankly, that is absolutely unworkable. And it's unworkable for two reasons. One is to ask an attorney to close down, and that's what they would have to do, close down his or her law practice in order to take this short-term position for a period of months. You're simply not going to get qualified applicants. You're not going to get people who say, oh, I've got a thriving practice, but, you know, I'm just going to shut it down. Do this for a few months, and I sure hope I've got clients when I get back because I can't serve them in the meantime. They'll have gone someplace else in the meantime. What you're going to get in that situation is, frankly, lawyers who don't have clients, lawyers who can't get clients, and are saying, well, this is a part-time temporary job I can work, and it's better than nothing. That's the first problem that you get with that. The second issue that you're going to run into is I've been a judge now for 4.5 years. It's not a job that you step into on day one and say, oh, I'm ready, bring me that first degree murder case. There's a considerable amount of training that goes on. And quite frankly, after a period of several months, you're a new judge is just starting to get comfortable with the job, is just starting to get a sense of what those responsibilities are. And to say we're just going to repeatedly fill positions with this revolving door of placeholders, I'll just tell you, I can't conceive of that possibly working. And so that's one of the issues that just isn't going to work. At this point, what I'd like to do is just step back. If there are questions that people would like me to address, I'm happy to answer any of those questions. Again, I know you've heard testimony that related to at least some of these tangential issues on Tuesday, and I've tried really hard not to repeat what I think you've heard on Tuesday. Happy to face any questions. Madam Chair, thank you.
Thank you. Are there, Representative Simon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Judge, I just came in, so I'm sorry to you and to everyone else if I'm repeating. What about the issue of retirements? We have the 70-year-old mandatory retirement here, and it seems to me, and I have constituents, for some reason I have several judges who are constituents, and they've approached me about this, and they've said, there was one in particular who approached me a few years ago before he was going to turn 70, and the issue often is that they turn 70, obviously sometime within their 6-year term. They're not looking to skirt or evade state law or do anything untoward. They're just, that's the way it is. You have to retire at the end of the month in which you turn 70. To what extent, I'm sure we could find this out statistically, but to what extent do those issues come into play in terms of when people retire, in your experience?
Judge Mess?
Madam Chair, Representative Simon, certainly there are circumstances where judges retire who would like to continue working past that 70-year retirement age. We had one of those recently in Anoka County as well. Someone who I think would have enjoyed continuing to work and did a very nice job. Whatever retirement age is picked is going to be, of necessity, arbitrary. And if that line moves a little one direction or another, I don't think that's going to change the world dramatically in our court system. If all we're talking about is whether in this bill or in a different bill, the retirement age for judges moves to the next even year after they turn 70 years old, I don't think the world's going to change dramatically. I'm still a little ways away from the 70-year-old line, and so it's something that I have not focused on for myself as much. It's one I probably will appreciate more as I get closer to that line. Small incremental changes one direction or another, I don't think they're going to change them.
Any other questions from members? If not, thank you very much, Judge Messel, for being here. And
thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee, for your time and attention.
Next, we'll have former Governor Al Quie. Oh. Okay, does anybody, let's see.
Thank you, Governor.
Are there any other opponents to the bill that wanted to speak? And now, Paul Volkhammer, did you want to speak? Okay. Sorry if I didn't pronounce your name right.
Volkhammer, thank you.
You could identify yourself for the record and continue.
My name is Paul Volkhammer. I'm a private citizen, former firefighter and elected supervisor in Baldwin Township. I testified on House File 1666, and I'm here today to ask you that to consider that this bill, HF 1474, is very important to me because judges in this state have greatly impacted my life. And I won't defer to the details that I did in that and under House File 1666 when I testified, but I will say that I have been negatively impacted greatly by the prejudice and the corruption that exists within our judicial system. And I think it's important that a person can choose the judge that they're going to go before, because you expect professional integrity. You expect them to follow the rule of law. I know many here would say that we already have a system in place that has checks and balances for the judicial system. I would say you're right. There are people writing judges' checks, and there are judges increasing their balances. But I don't see integrity from the bench. In the last 5 years, I've been before almost a dozen judges. I haven't been before a judge yet that followed the rule of law or had the integrity to sit on the bench. And I think what's needed, aside from a bill such as House Bill 1474, is a system that would revive a grand jury system and put in place an impeachment process that would work. I don't know the last time I've heard of a judge being impeached, but I know that as I sit here and listen, and I listened under 1666, all I heard were a lot of people saying how we have a wonderful judicial system. I haven't seen that. And I think that this notion that a private citizen cannot select a judge, that they won't have enough information, I think what they're actually afraid of is that a private citizen like myself has too much information, and they're afraid that they might disclose that information. Because, as I said in the other hearing, I recently had a judge rule against me and say that the rules of professional ethics do not apply in an attorney-client contract. A judge said that from the bench, and that very thing was upheld in the appellate court. I was denied an oral argument before the appellate court on that very notion, with a motion put against me that was granted before my attorney even received it. Two other motions were granted against me without my attorney even receiving it. This denial of due process cannot continue to exist in our court system in Minnesota. One of the things that Tim mentioned earlier was transcript denial. When I went before an oral argument in the appellate court, immediately the next day I called and asked for a transcript of the oral argument from the appellate court. Because of the things that were said there, I wanted that transcript so my attorney could prepare for the Supreme Court. Fred Grittner, the chief administrator for the appellate court, said, no, the rules of the appellate court are we deny transcripts. I said, fine, Mr. Grittner, I'll send you a letter. I sent him a letter and cited the Data Practices Act. And I said, under the Data Practices Act, which supersedes your court rules, I'm asking for a transcript of my hearing so that I can use it before the Supreme Court of the state of Minnesota. I received a letter back again with a photocopy of the court rules saying, you're denied your transcript. I again sent him a letter saying that you cannot deny my transcript. You're in violation of Minnesota Statute 1308. No response since then. It's been 6 months. When a private citizen that's been abused by the court system can't even receive a transcript of his own hearing, you have serious problems in the state of Minnesota. Now I hear this. I heard testimony under this bill 1666 that we're going to form this wonderful evaluation system that would comprise a panel of citizens, and it would have lawyers and citizens, and they would evaluate the judges, and we would have that system in place. So there's nothing to fear. But in reading over the language of the bill, it specifically says that you cannot evaluate a judge based on his judicial decisions. Could anyone here in this room please tell me, if you don't evaluate a judge on his judicial decisions, what are you evaluating? What I want to know
When I go before a judge in the state of Minnesota, and he took an oath to uphold the laws of the state and the Constitution of the United States and the state constitution, that's what he's going to uphold. I don't care if he's a Democrat, Republican, Protestant, Catholic. It doesn't matter. What matters to me is that he follows the rule of law. And I've seen judge after judge that I've been before violate the rule of law. And why we're here today is because we have a serious problem. HF 1474 just barely scratches the surface of what could be done. It's like fighting a forest fire with a squirt gun. We have a serious problem here in the state of Minnesota. And anyone in this room that would dare to differ with me can contact me, approach me afterwards, and I'll send you file after file for you to read, and I'll outlay it for you. But I can back up everything that I say with circumstance. I've spent over $100,000 of my own money in a whistleblower claim. 2 years I waited to get to court, and only to be denied on a corrupt summary judgment hearing. Summary judgment's the most abused tool in the system. Nothing more abused than summary judgment. It was an excellent idea when it was proposed, and it's very old, and it was to eliminate frivolous lawsuits. But in today's legal world, it's just used to abuse citizens seeking proper litigation before a judge. In my case, the summary judgment came 2 weeks prior to trial. I had spent my retirement fighting my termination from a fire department for the exposure of the formation of an illegal dive team, as verified by the state auditor. And so there was no way that my case applied under summary judgment. But summary judgment, the way the system is set up, let me explain it to you. It allows attorneys on both sides to extract huge amounts of money from a citizen over a period of several years. And then at the last minute, we can throw summary judgment out there. That way, neither side is deprived of any money. And it's unconscionable that this is being done on a daily basis. It's not just me. I've talked to many, many people that have had the same experience. I thank you for allowing me the time to speak today, and I thoroughly support HF 1474. Thank you.
Thanks very much. Anyone have any questions? Witness.
Have any questions?
Okay. Is there anybody else that needs to speak for or against? I think, okay, we'll take that person. I think that probably wraps up testimony from witnesses.
Hello.
Welcome to the committee. If you can please just identify yourself.
My name is Don Mashick. I actually spoke against 1666 a couple days ago. I'm here to speak for 1474. I've changed about three or four times exactly what I was going to say in response to various statements that were made. I'm going to say that for 20 years, I've been trying to petition the government under my First Amendment rights for redress of grievances involving the judiciary system. I'm not going to go into great details about my personal situation other than that. If you want to know what brings me here, go to wellsfargocorruption.com. I can't believe that I actually have to give a history lesson to the members of this committee. The United States was born out of the principles of the Enlightenment, which occurred from 1650 to the late 1700s. And out of that came the concepts of natural law and natural rights. I got to backtrack here. It amazes me that for 20 years I wanted to petition. For 6 years, hundreds of us have petitioned the Minnesota House and Senate Judiciary Committees to bring our grievances about the Minnesota Judiciary. And for 6 years, we've been unconstitutionally denied the right to petition those committees. But the judges suddenly want to change the way the elections are, and snap, snap, they get hearings. This relates to the appointments related to the mandatory retirement age, where These judges are stepping down or being required to step down because of this mandatory requirement, this mandatory retirement age, and then they get designated incumbents and they get reelected. And it really disturbs me that anybody would go with, we're technically in compliance with the Constitution, yet upon hearing that 90% or more of the judges that are appointed don't realize that that wasn't the intent nor the spirit of the original Constitution. Clearly the situation has been manipulated. Out of the Enlightenment, as I was saying, we had the concepts of natural law and natural rights. And in writing the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution, the founders incorporated that law in our inalienable rights. The fundamental understanding our U.S. founding fathers had in drafting our Constitution is people under natural law have free will and are not virtuous by nature. Therefore, governments must be constructed in anticipation of the nature of man. Acting on this knowledge, our founding fathers built in our government and Constitution various checks and balances. Amongst these checks and balances were transparency and accountability. Meaningful, contested elections are a necessary form of accountability. You'll have to pardon Mr. Volkmer for going into his details of his experiences with this government, but we've been, for 6 years, denied the right to tell you all the problems we have with the corruption of the Minnesota judiciary. You need to be asking your folks need to be asking yourself. Oh, I want to go back and say, I can't remember if it was Madison or Jefferson said that liberty is not usually lost in great and swift changes, but gradually over time. You're trying to take away the citizens' right to vote for their judges. And when people talk about judges, to the people not being informed, I allege that it's a deliberate act, that they deliberately don't let us, the Board of Judicial Standards doesn't release how many complaints there was about a judge, simply releasing the number of complaints and the disposition of those complaints would allow the citizens to say, everybody would get complaints, but we would know that the average number is 8, and if some judge is getting 100, we can cock an eyebrow and say, what's the situation there, and investigate that further. I guess I just want to close by saying, if the voters aren't qualified to vote for the judges, they're not qualified to vote for the people that would select the judges. And worse, in this 1666 proposal, the people would vote for elected officials who would select people who would then select the judges. That's just a situation that's ripe for abuse. It has been abused. And having said that, I'll accept any questions that anybody might have.
Thank you, Representative Simon.
Thank you. A comment, then a question. First of all, thanks for coming. I appreciate it today. As you're aware, I'm sure, at the federal system, there's no check. It's a lifetime appointment. So I think Minnesota, at least, there is a way for voters and for people to have their voice heard. But in the federal system, I don't know if what you're urging is an elected system on the federal level, but as you know, there it's pretty much a lifetime appointment. But my question for you is this, and I've heard this from other testifiers in other years on other bills, although some of the folks who have testified before are here today. I've heard talk before, and I've never quite understood it, and maybe you or one of your other the folks who are here with you can answer this, but I've heard this charge made, it's a serious charge, that judges in Minnesota are accepting bribes.
They codified it and it's legal.
I think it's important, and I think it's actually good that Judge Meslow and others here who represent the district court judges are here to hear this, because they should know what's being said. I've heard that before. It's never fully, and I've been one who's been very involved in kind of judicial issues over the last 3-4 years. and it's never been fully explained to me what people mean when they say that judges in Minnesota are accepting bribes. Can you tell us what you mean or what you think is meant by judges in Minnesota are accepting bribes?
Mr. Mashek, I'll let you answer that question, but I don't want to go into a great personal situation, no. if that would be okay.
No, and it just doesn't require me going to any great personal situation. If you go look at, and I can't think of it, the Board of Judicial Rules or the judicial rules, they've codified that you got to pick it out because it's in three different sections, how they can accept tips of up to $150 per day from any individual, and they don't have to report it. Now, you representatives, what's the amount that you can take each day, $5 or $10? I believe that's what it specifies in the rules for the representatives. And so you have, the allegation is that large law firms tell each of their, that have 100 or so people, go to each of their associates and say, today you're writing checks for $149 to this judge. And it's perfectly legal under the rules. And I think that's just wrong.
Representative Simon.
Madam Chair, thank you. I'm still not quite sure what that means. I'll look up the rule. You say that that's allowed. I've never heard of that, and I work at the kind of firm that you've just described. I've never gotten that memo or that email. But I'm not quite sure what you mean by tips. You mean lawyer? Are you alleging that lawyers who appear before judges, not just generically could appear, but who appear before them on cases, can pay them money? Is that what you're saying?
Yes. And they only have to report them if it's more than $150. And there's no limit to the number of $150 tips that they can take in a day, which, let's just call them bribes, because calling them tips is like the mafia calling a hit or a murder or an assassination a hit. It's still an assassination. And I'm not the only one that feels like this. Like I said, there is hundreds of us. I suggest that this committee get a hold of the tape that was made in an ad hoc hearing that then Representative Dan Severson held on judicial corruption, and look and see how many people showed up to give testimony in an ad hoc committee meeting, because the official Minnesota House and Judiciary Committees would not hear our testimony, would not let us give evidence for 6 years, hundreds of people for 6 years. Yet the judges show up and they don't want any more accountability, they want to get rid of the elections. They got their hearings.
Representative Simon.
Madam Chair, I was at that hearing that Representative Severson held. It was in room 316, I remember it. And I was there because I wanted to do so as a courtesy to people who had problems with the court system and listen to what they had to say. So I was at that hearing, and that's one of the places where I've heard this allegation. I mean, I've heard this issue about the rules, allowing tips, and all the rest. I've not heard anyone ever say that Judge X received a bribe or received a tip or anything like that. Have you?
I've heard, over the course of 20 years, I've heard it. I don't recall the specific instances, but I've heard it from enough people enough times to know it's true.
Okay, we have Mr. Wu, you're wanting to testify, and then let's try to and then I'll have Representative Anderson perhaps wrap it up.
Thank you very much, Madam Chairman. Chairwoman Joyce Pepin, thank you so much for holding this public hearing. My name is George Wu, W-U. I currently reside in the before redistricting possibility of Senate District 41, Edina, West Bloomington. That may become Senate District 48, we don't know. And it may remain and still reside in CD3, we don't know. It might be part of CD5 in the future. But that's on the aside. We heard that one of the sponsors on the bill HF 1666 on Tuesday is on the B side, 41B, Pat Masrow, a freshman, a GOP, and an attorney who was one of the seven GOP who sponsored that. By the way, through the grapevine, my own Senate district is very much aghast about this, and he will be held in account through our own local BPOU upcoming meetings. Meanwhile, in proponent of the three provisions of this particular bill that's being heard today, I just want to say from a citizen's point of view that the committee members may not be aware of, and I'd just like to bring to your attention. that last fall in seat 3, District 10, Judicial District 10, where Chris Penwell has testified that he was one of the 24 candidates in an open seat. Ask yourself this, why 24 were willing to file for just one seat for district court judgeship? Isn't that quite unusual? And how did that come about? And then ask yourself this, why did the top two vote-getters in a survey in an hour-and-a-half to two-hour forum held last fall in the district by the Tea Party Patriots and the Justice in Minnesota organization, where 14 of the 24 judicial candidates attended that forum, including Chris Penwell, that a very open forum and discussion about the judicial candidates' positions and why they're running for office and why they should and deserve the registered voters in their district, the 8 counties, get their vote. Why there was so much interest and desire. And for your general information, why of the top two vote-getters, the one who got number 2 as far as the most likely in the survey, actually end up winning the election? So there is, perhaps, for the committee members' understanding, that if information is provided, and more information is provided to the general public and the registered voters, there would be perhaps a large interest from the voters about judicial candidates, who they are, their resumes, their bios, their positions on certain political philosophies that through the White decision has now opened up in Minnesota the ability of judicial candidates to express themselves. And how would this help in upcoming and future elections for judges that the public awareness of being able to have open contested elections will be able to be of help and not a hindrance and also follow the United States, or in this case, the Minnesota Constitution? I pose to you a simple question. In a Larry Jacobs Humphrey Institute held forum just about 3 months ago, 4 panelists, and from the audience submitted questions, of which I submitted one question. And one of the 4 panelists was the former retired Chief Justice Eric Magnuson of the Minnesota Supreme Court. My question was this, and Larry Jacobs asked them. I simply asked, our framers of our Constitution in 1857, 1858 decided upon an elective position for judges, choose the elective position rather than having the appointment system for choosing our judges. Why is that so? And are you in favor or against it today? That, in paraphrase, was my question. Mr. Eric Magnuson proceeded to answer for about 2 minutes, and he said it was good for the first 150 years that we had an elective system for judges in Minnesota. Then he rambled on for the next 30 seconds, and finally he threw his hand up in the air and said, you know what? I don't know. I don't know. At least he was honest with that concluding remark, and I appreciated him for that. But today, on HF 1474, there are 3 issues and parts into the bill that I support and I approve. But this is just the beginning, as you say. It's a public hearing on the discourse of judicial reform, accountability, and transparency. And I just want to leave you with one final thought besides my support of this bill, and that is this. The state of Minnesota has the Tea Party movement. It may be a fledgling group, but it's part of the national fabric of the Tea Party movement about citizens who are getting involved and concerned about what's happening at the local, not just the federal and national levels of elected officials. This last winter, there was a nominal group process meeting by the leadership of the Tea Party movement in Minnesota to discuss what issues and what things they should discuss and promote in the next 2 years. There were 47 issues put on the chalkboards by the 8 subgroups of several hours of discussions. And would you believe, of the top 8, number 3, which is far cried below of 1 and 2, was the reduction in the size of the government in Minnesota. Number 2 was voter ID bill and passing a legislative bill on that part. What was the number 1 issue by the Minnesota Tea Party Patriots group, I ask you? Judicial reform. judicial reform was the number one issue for the next 2 years by the Tea Party Patriots group in Minnesota. You may want to ask yourself why that is. Thank you for your time, Madam Chairwoman. Thank you for the time for us to express our opinions. And feel free to ask questions of the previous very, very esteemed guests and honored speakers here that were here today. Thank you again.
Thank you. There were some comments earlier, and I've asked Mr. Gehring to read the section that we referred to, Representative Simon, and the exchange with Mr. Mashek about that $150 language, and I have just asked for clarification. I've asked Mr. Gehring to read that for us so we understand at least what the two were talking about. Mr. Gehring?
Madam Chair and members, I believe the rule that was referred to related to the $150 was referred to as a tip issue is something that's codified in the Code of Judicial Conduct. This is Rule 3.13, Paragraph B. It says, unless otherwise prohibited by law or by Paragraph A, a judge may accept the following without publicly reporting such acceptance. There are a number of items listed here. Item number 11 says a judge may accept any other loan, gift, bequest, benefit, or other thing of value with a value not exceeding $150 if the source is not a party or other person who directly or indirectly has come or is likely to come before the judge, or whose interests have come or are likely to come before the judge.
And that, and Mr. Gehring, that's codified by the Supreme Court, and that is not something that we have jurisdiction over. Is that correct?
Correct, Madam Chair.
Okay. Well, Representative Anderson, if you could maybe just wrap it up with the, if you need, wanted to have a guest or a witness wrap it up, that would be fine. If you could maybe just wrap it up in a couple minutes, though.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Thank you, committee, for giving us this time today and to present our bill. And we just have a couple comments about some of the things that, making comments about what the judge said. Can we just have a couple?
Yeah, if you describe, we've been going for about an hour and a half, and I promised committees that we'd try to keep it, or I promised the members we'd try to limit it to an hour and a half. So
I'll keep it brief.
Okay, thank you. Ms. Clark?
Thank you. I just have a couple of brief comments in rebuttal to what Judge Maslow had stated, and I will keep it brief. With regard to the placeholder, I would disagree that there are not judges available on the market to serve for 4 months or 6 months or a year. And you know who they are? They're the retired judges, and there's a lot of them. And they're really qualified. You know why? Because you made them retire at age 70. And they're out there, they're qualified, they're trained, and they're looking for work. In fact, that's who they use when they don't have enough judges in a particular circuit court now. If they have an empty calendar one day, maybe a retired judge comes in for a day, but judges come in for a month, 60 days, and those judges are available to be used. With regard to the size of the district, it seems that there are a couple of discussions that pass as ships in the night. You hear a lot of people say things like, well, but people don't vote for a judge and they don't know who their judge candidates are. Part of the problem is when we went to a statewide system from a county system, now there are in these districts, first district, fifth district, so many judges on the ballot, and some of them live counties away from the person who's voting. The idea is you make it smaller, make the list smaller, fewer to get a handle on. With regard to the large counties, there are 20 or so who run in Hennepin County every election. If they were designated, this judge is the chief judge. Out of all that 20, people would focus on chief judge, or this is going to be the presiding judge of criminal, or the presiding judge of family. There are ways of helping the voter figure out among the numbers, and those are some of the ideas.
Mr. Penwell?
Madam Chair, Chairwoman, the only thing I'm going to say is you've all had a long day, and this has been a long session, and I'm going to do you a favor and not make any comments at all. I'm sure we'll have additional opportunities to comment on these issues, and so I'll look forward to addressing this in the future.
Thank you. Representative Anderson?
Thank you for this time today, and look forward to working with you guys in the future. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Members, just a quick announcement here. We have to meet at least one more time for the pension bill, which I believe will be probably, we'll look at the session schedule hopefully next Monday or Tuesday. It should be ready for that, so I will keep you posted. Representative Hornstein?
Madam Chair, are you hearing anything about this committee potentially looking at a stadium bill before the end of the session?
I would entertain hearing a stadium bill if that, if the author of the stadium bill will ask me for a hearing when he is ready to have a hearing. I would be open to having a hearing.
Okay. Thank you.
I don't have word on that yet, though.
Okay. Thank you.
That is a potential. I think those might be the only two issues. I stand corrected. There are two campaign finance board appointments that will. Can we take those up? We'll try to take them all up in the same day. That would be similar to the Swenson appointment. With that, members, meeting adjourned.